You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Viet Le. He's in Amsterdam at the moment. Viet, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Brainerd.
So, Viet, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're probably doing multiple projects. What is it that you're working on now in probably different fields, right?
Yes. So I'm multitasking. I'm in Amsterdam partly because of Documenta and SBNL. So firstly, I'm working on my book. And then second thing, working on a related trilogy, which is a feature-length film. And the third one is I just finished curating a show, and so we're trying to put together the catalog for that. But all three projects more or less kind of deal with the same themes around representation, identity, like how do artists identify, and the politics of kind of global art markets. So it's interesting, you know, being here, having seen, I went to also to Münster, the once in a decade sculpture show, but thinking about how artists are presented or represented and how they position themselves.
So I want to talk more about that in your book and the related trilogy and in your curating. So to begin with, you're traveling now. You're based in LA, is that correct?
Yes. So half the year I teach at California College of the Arts in San Francisco. And my mom, you know, she lives in L.A. County, so I go back and forth. But so I basically split my time between California, Europe, and Southeast Asia, partly for my work and for other, relationships, et cetera.
Okay, so let's talk about your book. Can you tell me a little bit about what it's what you're working on now, perhaps, or maybe the chapter you're working on now, or we could discuss kind of an overview of the book and get into some of the topics around presentation that you're discussing.
Sure, it's a bit depressing. It's about trauma, but I also make art videos, but all the projects more or less center around this idea of trauma, but thinking through various strategies. Sometimes I use pop music videos. So the book itself looks at the traumas of history, wars, such as the Vietnam War. My name is Viet. I was born in Vietnam, and I was a boat refugee. And so the book looks at the traumas of history and the traumas of modernization, particularly rapid modernization in areas such as Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam and Cambodia. So oftentimes people think that modernization or modernity is, it's celebratory or it's lauded as a good thing. But then, living in San Francisco as well with gentrification and displacement, a lot of people are moved or experience other forms of trauma. So it's not just the traumas of history or of war, but it's also the traumas of rapid developments or gentrification. So the book asks, what is the relationship between more historical traumas and the traumas of the present and or the future? And that question underlies, I guess, actually all my work, the, artwork as well as the curation. Sounds a little bit, of a downer.
That's okay. Let's explore that question a little bit. And so perhaps can you give an example, could be from Vietnam or Cambodia, about trauma and how people maybe I shouldn't say adapting, maybe that's not quite the right word, but how people are coping or managing trauma, if that's in part what the book is getting at.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the kind of overdetermined narrative or trope that such locations, let's say Vietnam or Cambodia, it's the 42nd anniversary, this year of the military engagements in Vietnam. But oftentimes people think of that area as a kind of traumatized zone, or you think of, let's say, to engage in stereotypes in the Middle East, also as an area that is currently under duress. So I really question this framework, right? So what do we mean you know, but when we talk about trauma and why do we use these tropes and these terms. So for instance, you know, I think everyone knows about K-pop, more or less, right? Like, and it sounds like a kind of tangent, but I think there was a recent op-ed in the New York Times about Korea's involvement in Vietnam. And so some scholars have argued that the current, you know, South Korean government and the rise, you know, of, you know, K-pop and the strong economic development in South Korea was actually laid by blood money, because the U.S. government during the Vietnam War paid U.S. mercenary soldiers to fight in Vietnam. And that, you know, the millions of money basically underlaid that foundation for economic development. So that's the, while I was talking about this relationship between this traumatic history, right, and these forgotten histories and current development, economic development. So also another example is, for instance, in Vietnam, you know, people aren't really interested in talking about the war that happened decades ago. They're more interested in, you know, watching K-pop or popular dramas. And so my question, or my interest is also, what is that gap? Why does no one talk about it? Or why are people expected to talk about it? So that this sort of binary.
Right, that's interesting. And so, I mean, you're doing research, and part of your research, I would imagine, in the book is talking to people. And so that's a really interesting question, too, about why we can't talk about this. I mean, I guess as you were saying, you know, trauma is a bit of a downer, right? It's not like a popular topic to talk about, but obviously enormously important, and one that it's a conversation that's needed because of working through trauma or understanding it. So that's how do you talk to people, and do you, in researching your book and working on your book, are you talking to people and getting stories, or are you working in a different way?
So I mainly have training as an anthropologist, so I use anthropological ethnographic methods, but I'm also an art historian. And the book is focused on contemporary art. So when you think of major artists working or living in Cambodia or Vietnam, you know, for instance, Bit Pick, his work right now is abstract, but at times, just in the most recent documenta, even though he's showing these abstract grids, it always references his personal history and the Cambodian genocide and that historical trauma, even though the work does not directly address it. So this idea of artists from certain locations expected to have certain kind of narratives or certain frameworks is something I'm really interested in, and how artists, both artists and curators or the general populace narrate, you know, these discourses. So it's both hyper-visible and invisible. Another just quick connection is, you know, this discourse that we're having about refugees now, you know, Syrian refugees or North African refugees. You know, I was, as I mentioned, a boat refugee. And so when you think of Vietnamese boat refugees, you have certain images in your mind, and from perhaps American movies from the 80s and 70s, Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, etc. And so oftentimes it's like these, you know, spectacular masses of people that are suffering. And same thing with refugees today. You see these images of, let's say, the Syrian refugee quote-unquote crisis and people coming in, etc., in boats, similar to me. And this overdetermined trope of what that looks like. But at the same time, you know, we don't really hear a lot about North African refugees and the economic instabilities, and also our complicity in causing these instabilities in other parts of the world. So I think the book really looks at that, these both hyper-visible and invisible tropes in terms of how artists are expected to work, and then also just in terms of mass media, how we see and perceive these traumatized topographies or people.
Very interesting. So let's move into some visual representations of that. I'd like to talk about your curating and other work, but perhaps we should jump right into I think it's a current show up, Queering Contemporary Asian American Art. Is that correct?
That's up now. That's there's an online platform, and that is actually part of a book that I guess a pioneering book that I'm in. And so Karen Higa, who is an influential Asian American art curator a long time ago at this workshop in New York, said that we are the termites of art history. And that statement kind of stayed with us in the group, in the working group, because she's basically saying that we're really questioning the very foundations, the art historical canon, right, that we as Asian or Asian American, depending on how we identify, are really eating away at what we assume is canonical or is, foundational kind of Eurocentric art history. So just in terms of the that book and the show is the kind of related online platform, so it's up for viewing. I have some videos up. My work, even though it's kind of couched in questions around trauma, I don't want to replicate these hyper traumatic rhetoric or images. So I actually use pop music videos. So on one hand, they look really fluffy and cheesy. I write the songs. I do everything because it's pretty low budget. But they've been mistaken as pop acts. For instance, I've been hailed as a hot new, Vietnamese pop act in, Khmer Press, et cetera, or in Southeast Asia. But I really like that flippage. So people think I'm a pop act, but I use that form, the viral video form, and what you see in the show is just snippets from that to talk about these deeper histories, these longer, for instance, the latest video I did is trying to put the camp in refugee camp, but so there's no images of refugees, but this kind of imaginary, I had a solo show in Bangkok, this imaginary refugee camp, but which is actually in a closed down boy bar. And so they're both Southeast Asian and Eastern European refugees in this kind of strange disco space.
Interesting. So then what will happen with your that's what's happening now with videos. You're making videos, correct? And you're is part of that what's going to move into the trilogy of films that you're talking about?
Yes, I just finished my first experimental trilogy. It's called Love Bang, and you can see the first one online. It's the whole trilogy is a trans, time-traveling love triangle. So that's completed. I'm actually starting work on another trilogy, and it's related. But this one, the first one was, they're about 5 minutes each, but this one I'm working on right now and doing research on is feature length. So they're 90 minutes, and each segment is 30 minutes. Just real quickly, you can talk about the three segments.
Let's do that. Let's go through three of them because that sounds interesting. And this is the trilogy that you were talking about that you're working on now, or is there another trilogy
It's the current one. I filmed the first one. I'm currently editing, so it should be hopefully up for a show at Pitzer called Manifesto in LA. But so the trilogy is a musical documentary. I know La La Land was huge, but I was thinking about this for a while. There's an upsurge in musical interest, but I'm trying to combine the musical form with documentary form. So the first one is about Nhạc Vàng, which, again, this ties into my interest around trauma and pop culture. Nhạc Vàng is known as golden music in Vietnam. So I was just in Hanoi last winter filming. I call him Vietnamese Elvis, but that's just my imaginary. So he was quite a well-known Vietnamese pop star, and he sang all these love songs that are quite heartbreaking. But at a certain time, these innocuous-seeming love songs were banned by the socialist Vietnamese government because they were subversive. So for instance, there's a great book called The Sympathizer by Viet Nguyen, who I know that kind of views the war from both sides. But from the socialist side, if you're promoting a fighting a war, you have you know, content that supports the war effort, but these songs are subversive because basically the songs are love songs, and some of them are about loss, like, you know, I'm missing my lover, where are you? And of course, the lover's missing, if you read between the lines, because of the war. So this man, Lok Van, who owns now a karaoke cafe, and his colleagues in the north and also in the south were imprisoned. And there's, you know, many people, you can do research on Google this, that were imprisoned for either composing or singing these love songs. Now, in Vietnam, they're quite popular, so it's quite ironic. So that's the first part of the trilogy. I filmed interviews with him and people that go to his cafe and people that sing it and putting it in a larger historical context, but also kind of restage his youth. So there are, like, kind of will be video snippets, recreations of, you know, his kind of sexy Elvis pompadour youth, and then and this kind of imaginary of what the songs did and do. So that's the first part. The second one is actually about Thich Nhat Hanh, who is arguably the most famous Zen monk, and then Martin Luther King nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize, but he's quite ill. But so he's living in France right now, and there's also a meditation retreat in San Diego, but a large part of his work or his meditation retreats are around his songbooks, the songs that he wrote. And so a lot of his practitioners, I'm also a meditator, you know, sing these songs as a way to commune or to be in touch. And so that's the second part. And then the third part, which I'm still doing research on, is also thinking about music, but also refugees then and now. So the through line is music and spirituality. And so I guess I call it sonic spirituality, thinking about musicals and documentaries. So that's also actually some preliminary research for my second book, which is about music and spirituality and visuality.
I like the idea of sonic spirituality. Has a really nice sound to it. So this is really interesting. I mean, that's the trilogy that you're working on. And where will that be shown, or how is that presented?
So I'm still, you know, I guess I'm kind of plugging, still fundraising. In the past, the first trilogy, Love, has been shown in different venues. So, and I expect this new trilogy is going to have the same circuit. So they're either shown in museums and galleries, so commercial galleries, or nonprofit spaces as video installations. So oftentimes I make objects, sculptural objects, to go with the installations. Or oftentimes they also do the international film circuit in the shorts section. So, you know, it's been screened at the Bangkok Art and Cultural Center. I just had a show in L.A. So they have different venues. And then, of course, the kind of online component, you know, in my mind, they'll go viral. But, you know, okay. Pipe dream.
That's exciting. Yeah, well, that's you have to. Before we talk about curating, which I'd like to talk a little bit about, you mentioned you're in the midst of fundraising, because, of course, these trilogies and all your work is requires funding, and it seems like isn't easily in the marketplace. So can we talk just a little bit about fundraising? How do you do that? Is that through grants? Is that personal appeals? How do you fundraise for these projects?
I think there's some film character that said, "No money, no honey." So, bad joke. But yeah. So, as an organizer, as a curator, depends on the project. Oftentimes, let's say for the film, you know, before I started making experimental films, I got a quote, you know, if you went through just regular production routes, then a project would cost $25,000 or $50,000. That's not a lot by mainstream, quote-unquote, Bollywood standards, but for an independent artist like myself, that's quite a chunk. So some of it's through grants. So I was lucky enough for my first trilogy to get an Art Matters grant and some other, you know, LA Pacific Asian Film Festival, Visual Communications, basically community grants and arts grants, and some of it I just had to, you know, pocket money, and some of it have been other in-kind sponsors. So that's just for the art projects. I've been pretty lucky in terms of getting grants, and I'm also on panels where, you know, I'm really happy to give out grants as well. For the curatorial projects, oftentimes it's working with institutions. So if museums, have variable funding. I did this show called Transpop, Korea Vietnam Remix with Young Soon Min. And so I was traveling from Korea to Vietnam to Gilbert Bunnan Center for the Arts in San Francisco and UC Irvine. But so each site had a different funding amount. And so we were able, working with other community organizations, to make up the difference. And that, you know, cost quite a lot. And recently, just as a semi-tangent, I co-organized a conference which was about arts and activism and academia. And that was actually funded by a Mellon grant. So that was about $90,000. So you can see, you know, ranging from $5,000 to, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It varies on the scope of the project. But I think that's a separate skill. You know, as you know, I'm not good at math, but
right.
It's a totally separate skill.
But is it a separate skill, meaning a separate skill to find and apply for grants?
I think both. I find and apply for grants, but then also, let's say, as an organizer, community cultural arts organizer, as I am, when you're working on, which I did, directing a film festival, getting funders for that. So developing relationships with funders or funding bodies, right, which is different from just, you know, sending in that art application and this is what my, project is about in simple language. You know, as a grad student doing my PhD, I also had to learn that skill, just, you know, translating your work, which I guess I didn't do so well in this interview, to a general audience. You know, why is it important, or why is it, you know, who cares really about, you know, wars that happened decades ago in Southeast Asia? Why is it relevant now? Why is it, you know, how does it tie to popular culture? You know, why is this project relevant beyond my personal interest?
And so that's, you're saying in terms of funding, that's part of the skill that you needed to develop or use in order to talk with, as you were saying, like in larger projects like the film festival, or where it's not just grants. Is that what you're saying? That kind of articulation is what's needed in that scenario?
Yeah, and oftentimes, you know, it's just not that one project where you're seeking funding from, but of course, you know, it's longstanding relationships that you're going to work with these community partners down the line for other projects, and perhaps you will also be a funder as well, you know, so it's both sides. And I know you've written books that help demystify that process for artists. So,
I'm always interested in, of course, I write grants as well, or apply for grants. And, but I'm always interested in how other people do that. So, last question about that is when working with the film festival or something else, you're that's not grants. You're approaching individuals and corporations and companies. Is that how that's done?
Yeah. So sometimes it's just, you know, cool calls, or have an assistant or a co-curator I'm working with. Of course, we've hired a team, and of course that took a grant. But yeah, just kind of saying, okay, this is our project, having a clear outline of what the project is, whether it's a kind of film festival or an art project. This is what I want to show and screen, kind of clear legible language, proposing it. And sometimes they might not be receptive. Sometimes they are, and sometimes, you know, it's not money. Sometimes it's just, resources. So for a film festival, they may donate in-kind services like publicity or volunteers. Or, for instance, when I did my first trilogy, many of my friends volunteered their time because I also helped them with their projects. And so, you know, I couldn't afford to pay them, you know, regular working fees. But, of course, it's a collaboration. And, of course, I believe in paying everybody for their time and effort. But so there's other ways rather than just like a money system. It could be kind of collaboration, art trade, that kind of thing. my for more institutional work, then of course, I think that's one thing I learned from my friend who is a full-time fundraiser, is it is partly about the relationships you form. You know, a cold call is much harder than someone that you've had a working relationship, that, you know, someone that you can recommend, et cetera, or that can recommend you. And they might not always give you, you know, the money. It's not always about asking for the money for this project. You know, it's about kind of a larger community support and, you know, infrastructure and helping kind of forward certain kinds of narratives.
That's interesting. As you're saying, it is about relationships and continuing a conversation. And, you know, at the same time, there is also cold calls being made to people, it sounds like, who you or the team that's helping doesn't know to introduce new individuals or members to the project. Is that correct?
Yes. So it's both, and being able to, in some ways, be fearless, right? Like, you believe in this project, and then just knocking on the door or just an email. It helps if you have a, you know, someone that knows someone that knows someone.
Right. And so lastly, I want to ask you about curating. Do you want to talk about recent curatorial project?
Sure. I just finished co-curating the show called Love in the Time of War, with Jennifer Vanderpool. And so I was traveling from UC Santa Barbara to SF Camera Work, which is a kind of pioneering and important art space, lens-based. And so the questions which I brought up earlier in the interview about, you know, how do we respond in this time of crisis? How do we make meaningful and effective change? I mean, just kind of, they sound like naive questions. But, you know, I was really, I guess, sad and continually so, thinking about, you know, that we're in basically an eternal war. And so how do we respond as artists and makers? So the title of that show, Love in the Time of War, is from Yusuf Kuminyaka's cycle of poems. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. And Iran is Pulitzer Prize for this series of poems that he wrote during the Vietnam War. But the show, also, as I've mentioned, some of my interests, connecting it to current wars. So thinking about intimacy and the states and intimate statements and the relationship between the body and the body politic and artistic responses around that. So, you know, we've had artists from within and without Asia, artists in the U.S., a great project was by Niyu Ali, who had a performance at the Smithsonian that had a lot of trouble, and we were able to do an iteration performance. We worked with the Asian Art Museum and SF Camera Works, so she was in a red chador, which is kind of, you know, the chador is such a politicized symbol and also a gendered and racialized symbol that is, for, you know, feared. And so
wait,
we had her
to say it again. What is this symbol?
Oh, the chador, basically, kind of the veil, right? So she has a sequence. She dresses from head to toe in the chador, this Muslim, veil, and she kind of is a silent. Manita is a silent character, just walking the streets, but people have different responses. So when she was doing it in San Francisco, walking down the streets, one man said to her, you know, I was in Iraq and I saw people like you. And of course, you know, the figure is silent, so she just moves on. But she said that was some of the most kind of, you know, she's done it in France right after, you know, terrorist bombings, et cetera, in the UK.
So wait a minute, let me just be clear. So, so she's walking, the performance is walking through the streets in this kind of veil, but it's this full body veil. So we're not seeing her eyes or anything. Is that correct?
Yeah, you see some of, I think you do see her eyes, but it's not very, you know, it's largely from a distance, it's just this red figure who's actually covered in sequins, So that kind of work, kind of really thinking through what she did at the Smithsonian, it was an installation where she was standing in front of a bunch of U.S. flags. So thinking about this idea of threat, and this, again, idea of gendered and racialized threat. So, but, and actually people...
Well, it's also very simple, right? I mean, she's standing there in front of the flags, and it raises questions. She's, as opposed to a performance where you're making a particular statement about how you think or feel about something, it sounds very, very powerful because it brings up a lot of questions and elicits responses, maybe like that guy walking by or others.
Right. It's not a simplistic kind of didactic commentary. And this ties back to this idea of, you know, oversimplified representations of trauma, that we're expecting certain things from certain artists from certain regions. And I think this project, and there are other, I think we have some online projects that you can see at loveinthetimeofwar.com that respond. Karen Finley and Bruce Yamamoto just real quickly had a project where Karen Finley is actually embodying Donald Trump. And so it sounds ridiculous, some of the what she's saying, but they're all taken from, things that he said. So it just sounds totally outlandish and kind of crazy. And it's they connected to Senator Phelan. They had a residency at Montalvo. And about 100 years ago, Senator Phelan passed the Anti-Asian Immigrant Act. It's basically the Asian Exclusion Act. So this kind of anti-immigrant rhetoric, you know, has been going around. And it also affected Muslims, Asians, et cetera. So this kind of connecting different nodal points in time, then and now, is important for me as a curator and artist.
Well, that also ties together, you know, as you were saying, we're actually in the middle of the interview giving talks or presentations on the relevancy of work or research on the past to now. That's what you're talking about. That's what she does, and what you were just saying. That is the relevancy to now, and looking at all these issues is these are issues we're currently struggling with. We're as you say, we are in an endless war, and also struggling with racial and gender bias, and it just continues. It couldn't be more contemporary. Is that correct? Am I paraphrasing that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, the statistic last year, 2016, in the U.S., about 1,000 racialized deaths, right? And, you know, this year alone, there's been like 600. And so this isn't exceptional. I think this is actually common, right? So it's not just we're war overseas, but we're at war on our streets. And so I think as an academic, you know, do I sit there and, you know, write my book, or as an artist, then what are the strategies whereby which we can respond, right, and effectively respond?
Yeah, I think that's an important question for all artists to be thinking of. You know, what are the strategies to respond in a situation that we're all in or under or around? So before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading right now. Question I ask everyone at the end. It could be off topic or anything at all.
A book I just finished reading is called The Intimacies of Four Continents. So as I was speaking about intimacy and the state and state violence, it's by Lisa Lowe, and it's a really brilliant book. So she talks about our historical violences, the slave trade, Native American genocide, Asian American exclusion, Chinese laborers working in the U.S. On the railroads 100 years ago. So these seemingly disparate events, right? So she makes a case that they're intimately connected, right? The four continents, as we see today, right, are so intimately connected, and these violences are so intimately connected. And so I think it's really brilliant and groundbreaking because it's both an interdisciplinary and methodological kind of pioneering work that oftentimes with area studies, you're just focused on a particular area, you know, Southeast Asia, as I do, or, you know, if you're an Africanist or a Caribbeanist, you're just tied to that area and to that history. But she really makes a case. She, you know, paraphrasing another scholar, says that democracy is, then and now is contingent upon slavery. And I think that was such a, you know, I was shocked by that statement, but I thought about it, like, now, historically, we have the most number of people that are under conditions of servitude, right? And also the largest number, arguably, historically, of people that are migrating as refugees or as migrants. So this kind of, quote-unquote, chaos or this crisis, historically, can be traced, right, to these larger movements across the globe. So I think, you know, that's something I recommend. I also read poetry, so Ocean Vuong's book. And then since I was, my next book is on spirituality, I've been reading some books, you know, on shamanism and other things.
Great. Well, Fiat, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.